Grateful for everyone here tonight. We're going to be continuing our study this evening of the book of Esther, if you'll open up there with me. We'll be beginning tonight in Esther chapter 5 and do a little bit of review as we begin tonight. I just want to remind us of the situation here in the book of Esther. It continues to impress me as we go back to this book, just what a desperate situation God's people were in this day, as they've been carried off into captivity, stripped from their homes, and they've now been separated from the land of Israel for a number of decades. And the children that are born in this generation don't really know the Zion that their parents knew. And they've really been distanced from God and His laws and His people in a lot of different ways. And now they're being targeted to be exterminated. And it is a really desperate situation because, as we mentioned last week, you remember that when Haman's decree went out of what's going to happen, this was not just the Jews in the Susa, the capital, where a lot of the events of this book are happening, but it's the Jews in all of the empire. This is all of the Jews in the known world who are going to be exterminated. And so we just have a really desperate situation for God's people. If they're annihilated, this is the line of the Messiah we're talking about. This is the future of God's people, the promises to Abraham, the promises to David that are at stake even as we go through this book. So you'll remember in chapters 1 through 4, just briefly summing up each chapter. In chapter 1, we had King Ahasuerus' banquet, King Xerxes in history, Vashti's refusal to come before the king. We're going to see some interesting parallels to that with Esther's presentation before the king in chapter 5. And the edict that went out that every man should be master of his own household. And just the interesting implications there about, well, it makes a difference in the life of a nation, what the families are doing and how the men are ruling. No, I think an overreaction of the king there, but an interesting point nonetheless. In chapter 2, Esther, of all of the young virgins that were brought to the king to have one night with him, Esther is the one who finds favor with the king. And there at the end of the chapter, of course, just foreshadowing, Mordecai saves the king from a plot from two of his own men, which we remember in history later on, Xerxes or Ahasuerus will be killed later on by a plot like this. So this is a real threat to the king that Mordecai discovers the plot, saves the king, and that's going to be very relevant in our study this evening. In chapter 3, you remember Mordecai defies Haman. We talked last time about some of the reasons why that may have been. You remember that Haman was in the line of who? Going all the way back, he is going back to, he's an Agagite of the house of Agag, an Amalekite. And you remember that Mordecai, you can trace his lineage back to Kish, of the house of Kish, who, of course, is of the family of Saul. And so you've got this ongoing feud that really started, as we talked about, all the way back when Israel came out of the land of Egypt and Amalek ambushed them there and they fought against Amalek. And God said, listen, I am putting a curse on Amalek through all generations. Like, they're going to be annihilated. That's why Saul, God told Saul, you remember in 1 Samuel, go and utterly destroy the Amalekites. And so Saul, of course, didn't do that. And so here we've got really the continuation of that story. Is, you know, it's just Haman and Mordecai, kind of mortal enemies from a long time back that are involved now. And so Haman, again, overreacting in somewhat the way of the king here, is going to, it's a kind of a personal encounter, but it results in Haman's plot to destroy all of the Jews in all of the empire. Which, of course, this news reaches the Jews in chapter 4. We have them mourning Mordecai, going about the city in a very public fashion. And Esther's like, what's going on? You know, she sends him some clothes at first. And a little bit unusual. It seems like every Jew in the nation knows what's going on except for Esther, who's in the palace. And Esther finds out what's going on. And Mordecai explains to her in no uncertain terms, listen, this is your moment. It may well be that you were brought to the kingdom for this moment, and you have some decisions to make, because if you don't do this, don't think you're going to escape, and deliverance will arise from the Jews from somewhere else, but you and your family's house will be taken out, basically. And again, I don't think we can see Mordecai's response, even though God's name is never mentioned in the book of Esther. I don't think we can see Mordecai's response there as anything other than faith in God. By what other way would he know that, well, deliverance is going to come from somewhere else except for you? You know, I really think Mordecai trusts in the Lord. And even though I don't think Mordecai and Esther have made all good decisions in this book, I think we see them in this moment being God's tools to rescue his people in this moment. And so as we begin chapter 5 tonight, I want to again just try to help us think about trying to read this as though we're reading it for the first time. If you're anything like me, you've heard the story of Esther since you were young, and it's kind of like, okay, yeah, here's the next part of the story. But this is dramatic. As Esther is taking her own life into her hands and coming before the king, she knows, chapter 4, that there is just one rule. If you come into the king's presence uninvited, and that is they kill you. Again, it may be, if you've ever seen those relief carvings that, you know, there's always the guy next to the throne with the big axe, you know, and it may well have been like his job was to take care of uninvited visitors by taking off their heads. And so that's the position that Esther is putting herself in as she goes before King Ahasuerus. We ended our study last time with Esther's agreement to say, yes, I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. We didn't note this at the end of the study last week, but I want us to just take a second as we're introducing the study tonight to think about the development of Queen Esther. Because you remember when Queen Esther was introduced in chapter 1, Esther is this orphan child who not only has she been taken away from her people and taken away into this foreign nation, but she doesn't have parents. She's being raised by her cousin, Mordecai. And she has no real place in the world. I mean, this is about the lowest of the low positions that you could have. And Esther isn't really doing anything at the beginning of the book. She's taken by the king. Mordecai gives her some advice. The king's advisor gives her some advice that wins her favor in the eyes of the king. But she's not really taking any initiative, making anything of herself. She's just doing what she's told. And she's not really, I don't think she's really even following God's commands in chapter 1. She ends up married to this pagan king, as the Lord didn't want them to do. Esther is just going with the flow when the story begins. But as we've gone through, we've seen Esther, as she's become queen, at least showing some concern for Mordecai when this plot has arisen against the Jews. But now, really, it's at this point in the book that Esther has really begun to take charge. And up to this point in the book, you'll remember that it's been Mordecai telling Esther, okay, you do this, you do this, you do this. It seems like Esther has almost no information inside the palace, but Mordecai hears about everything, through one way or another. And so Mordecai has been, okay, here's what needs to happen, and has been working. He's the one, of course, who tells Esther, okay, you've got to go to the king. Nobody else can do that. But notice the very last phrase of chapter 4, then Mordecai went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. And so there's another sense in which this is kind of a turning point in the story, in the development of Esther's character, is that she is now really becoming the queen that she has been appointed to be in some way. She is now starting to take initiative, and she's like, okay, here's the game plan. And we're just going to see a real change in her as we go through this book. And again, I just think that's fascinating as we read about these real people and the change that occurs in them. When you look at people like Peter and people like David and people like Nicodemus, these people in the scriptures that start out and they've just got all these flaws, they're falling, they're making bad decisions, other people are kind of deciding what's going on. But how the Lord develops and uses these people, small and insignificant though they may seem in the world, to do great things and to develop in themselves the spiritual and moral backbone to stand up when no one else is standing up. I just think that's really cool as we go through the story of Esther to see how she is changing and growing as we go. So let's begin this evening, Esther chapter 5. Let's read verses 1 through 8. And again, the drama of this moment is easily lost on us, but let's try to read this with fresh eyes. Esther chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. On the third day, and remember this is the third day after they've been fasting and likely praying as well, On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne, inside the throne room, opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, pause for dramatic effect, she won favor in his sight. I don't know how long that moment would have lingered for Esther, but she kind of stands there, kind of waiting, like, okay, what's going to happen? Which, by the way, the fact that she asked for a fast for 3 days and she herself was fasting was another sign of faith. Because when you come before the king, and pretty much the only thing you have in the king's eyes is your beauty, and you fast for 3 days, I mean, you're probably not going to necessarily be looking your best. So it's interesting that she participated in this fast. On the third day, she appears before the king. And I think, again, the Lord's hand is right here. She won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. And then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter with great relief, I'm sure. Verse 3, and the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you even to the half of my kingdom." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther has asked. So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king said to Esther, "What is your wish? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled." Then Esther answered, "My wish and my request is, if I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleased the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." So Esther here risks her life by coming into the presence of the king. It's kind of interesting. You remember Vashti was risking her life by refusing to come into the presence of the king in chapter 1. Now Esther risks her life coming into the presence of the king against the law. But of course the king here holds out his scepter to her, grants her what she wants, and even says, which, by the way, you remember, it's been a month since she's seen the king. Chapter 4, verse 11, it's been 30 days since the king has asked to see her. And so it may be that some other member of the harem has captured his attention. And so she is not in the best position right now to go to the king. And yet the king accepts her. And then he offers half his kingdom. Which, does that remind you of anybody in the Bible? You remember, it's the same thing that Herod had said when on his birthday, you know, "You can have anything you want, half my kingdom," when, you know, Herodias' daughter danced before him and all that. And it seems that this may have been kind of a customary thing. I don't know how literally he meant, like, "Okay, I would like half your kingdom. Yes, please." Or if it's just kind of a customary way of saying, "You can have almost anything you want, up to half the kingdom," you know. Equal with me is kind of the idea. So he offers this thing, and I think the king knows that Esther hasn't just come in to ask him to dinner. Because that's, of course, the first thing that she asked for. But when they do get kind of done with dinner and they're drinking wine, it's amazing how much reference there is to drinking wine here. That's just something that the king really loved to do. That when they finish with this, the king asks her again. I don't think it's like, "Oh, well, that was really nice, Esther. I'm glad you asked me to dinner. Glad that we could get together. See you next time." No, he says, what is it that you want? And asked her again, "Up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you." And Esther again says, "Let's do round two. Tomorrow night, I'll prepare a dinner for the king again." And then I think the idea there at the end of verse 8 is she's saying, "And tomorrow I will do as the king has asked." Basically, I'll tell you tomorrow what it is. And so it's kind of interesting how Esther here is kind of stringing the king along a little bit and building the anticipation for what is this that the queen wants, that, you know, she wouldn't ask me when she risked her life to come into the throne room. She wouldn't ask me on the dinner the first night. And so we got the second night of the dinner coming up. And so the king, I think she's kind of piqued his interest. He's like, what's going on here? It's intriguing the way that she's set this up and prepared this. Now, one interesting question in the midst of all of this is, who else, of all people, does Esther invite to the banquet? She invites Haman. And I'm not sure I'm positive as to the answer to this question. That's an interesting question to ask as we go through this. Why invite the very person you know is seeking the destruction of all of your people? Why invite him to the banquet? And there's a lot of proposed answers to that. But I think part of the idea may be that Esther knows that the king can kind of be easily swayed by whoever happens to be around him. Again, over and over in this book, we've seen Ahasuerus kind of go along with whatever the ideas of whatever advisor happens to be by and say, oh, I think you should do this. I think you should do that. Okay. He's just kind of approving plans left and right. And it may be that Esther wants Haman to be there when she kind of lets the cat out of the bag and says, it's him. Because she might be able to get the king angry, but then if Haman kind of gets to talk with the king on his own, Haman might be able to fandangle something else with the king. And so she may want Haman to be present at that moment when, as she's preparing to unveil this plot against her people, which of course the king still doesn't know that Esther is a Jew or a Jewess. So that may be part of the answer here. It's kind of an interesting thing to speculate about as we go through this, that Esther is wisely preparing for potential situations that could arise as she's plotting to save her people. So Esther has plans for this second night. And now meanwhile, we're going to read about what's going on. And again, this is just very dramatic. As Esther has received some initial success. I mean, she's taken the risk. She says, if I perish, I perish. And she did it. She was able to get to the king, but she hasn't saved her people yet. We're still kind of in the midst of this drama, and now things are going to get even more complicated as Haman is going to go home from this first dinner, and we're going to see what happens here next. Verses 9 through 14, Esther chapter 5. And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife, Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions which the king had honored, with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, as long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. One thing I had kind of forgotten about as I was reading the story again was what a short time frame this plan has, is this is supposed to happen before the next banquet, the next night. This is kind of a one-day operation. And it's kind of funny to me that Haman didn't do this at first. You know, when the first time that Mordecai didn't bow and pay homage to him, he didn't say, listen, just take him out. Go build a gallows and hang him. He says, no, we're going to take out the whole nation. And now Haman's had his way. The king gave him his signet ring. You remember, he has permission to do whatever he wants. And he's going to give this huge revenue to the king in the process. And so Haman is leaving the first night of the banquet, and he's joyful and he's glad of heart, except for one thing. I mean, how full of yourself do you have to be, you know, to be in a position where you got everything you want, except that one guy who won't bow down, you know? And you know what's amazing to me is people who are truly in a position of greatness aren't really worried about what other people think about them, you know? And here, I think we see just how small Haman really is, because he can't get over not everybody being just infatuated with him and bowing the knee to him. And I think that's a kind of a sobering thing to think about when we think about the way we react in our life to different people, that it's easy to see in Haman here the tremendous arrogance, the tremendous pride that this man must have had to have all of these things. And here's the one guy, and he's just, yet all this means nothing to me, you know, except for this one fly in the ointment, so to speak. And yet how many times we can kind of be the same way, you know? There's that one thing that just really grates on us, really gets on our nerves, and we might be blessed in whatever other way, but how many times are we Haman, you know? and act in the same way. And so, and it's also interesting here, Haman just, he goes home to his wife and his friends, who probably already know about these things, but he's recounting all the splendor of his riches and the number of his sons and all these different things. I can't help but wonder him recounting the number of his sons to his wife, and she's like, trust me, I know. And again, just interesting to see Haman's fullness of himself as he goes through this. And so he's most recently gloating, of course, over this banquet. And he's like, well, what am I going to do? And it's interesting that here, even after Haman himself, with this issue or this decree that's been issued in chapter 1, let every man be the head of his household, now Haman is listening to the voice of who? His wife. It's her idea to have this plot against Haman. And who does this remind you of a little bit? Of the guy who has everything he wants except for the one thing, and he sulks about it, and he's in a position of power, and it's his wife who says, there, I'll go take care of the one thing that you can't get. It's just like Ahab and Jezebel, isn't it? With Naboth's vineyard. I mean, we just see echoes of other biblical accounts as we go here, and the weakness of the men in this account is just kind of breathtaking as we go through that the men are not leading like the men need to lead. And so, just like Ahab listens to Jezebel here, Haman has apparently an equally wicked wife who, it's really kind of ridiculous. This is overkill to make a gallows this high. I mean, my understanding is this is about 75 feet high, this gallows. And some people have speculated this is kind of a measure, not so much of the gallows itself, of his hatred for Mordecai. We're not just going to hang him. We're going to hang him on a gallows 75 feet high. Can you imagine that? If you had a gallows, I'm sure that's probably taller, maybe even than this room. I'm not sure how tall this auditorium is. But man, I mean, you want to hang him where everybody can see it. Just make a public spectacle of this thing. I will say that it's kind of interesting. There's some speculation with the way this is translated that it could have been not necessarily a gallows that he's hanged on, but this 75-foot high stake that he's impaled on. A little bit more gruesome there, but that's a possibility in the culture there. And so there's some debate over that. Either way, it's overkill. I mean, he's wanting to kill Mordecai in this gruesome way in front of everybody and to do it in the next 24 hours. Before there's a chance, he says that you can go ahead and kill him, and you can kind of be at, his wife is saying you can be at peace then to go and actually enjoy the second banquet since Mordecai has taken away all your enjoyment, of the first banquet. Which brings us to chapter 6. And I really think, after some study, listening to some different sources on this book, I think this really is the climax of the book. And what's amazing to me, as we go through chapter 6, I want you to note who's present, and I want you to note who's not present almost at all in this chapter, as we read through this. Chapter 6, let's read together, verses 1 through 11. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the chronicles, as they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" And Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall be done, so thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robes and the horse as you have said, and do so to Mordecai, the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Up to this point in the story, everything has been going Haman's way. Everything has been going so smoothly except for Mordecai, but it seems like he's been getting his way, and he's just on this evening. The reason he's in the court is to tell the king about the plan to kill Mordecai, and with the way things have been going with the king is probably going to say, "Yeah, sure, whatever you want. You know, here's my signet ring. You know, do whatever you want with it. I can't..." Oh, he didn't bow down. And so this is just a moment of truth where you're right on the verge of Haman getting to the king. But before Haman can get to the king, all of these things just fall into place just by chance. Because it's interesting, who's absent here? No Esther, no Mordecai. The people who we think of as being the main movers and shakers, the main characters of the story, are completely absent from this part. And I think that's almost intentional, because we've been thinking about, okay, what's Esther going to do? What's Mordecai going to do? How are they going to plan? How are they going to pull this off? And the night when everything starts to change, the night when everything falls into place to make this plan work, neither of them are around. All of this just seems to happen by chance. And I think that what we see here is the author is just leaving this. I mean, he never says it, but he makes it so obvious in the way that he presents the story. The main characters are absent, but God is right there. God is all over this. Just think through this night for just a minute. Okay, the king can't sleep. I don't know if he had regular insomnia or not, but on this particular night, for whatever reason, the king can't sleep. Okay, not too much coincidence there. Now, what sorts of things could the king have asked for if he wanted to sleep? He's the king, after all. I mean, he could have had, you know, entertainment brought in. He could have maybe had some of the palace musicians come in and play him something, like Saul wanted, you know, like to soothe him back to sleep or something. He could have had any number of things. You know, he could have had some food brought in. One of the king's favorite things seemed to be drinking. Maybe he could have, you know, drunk himself and then kind of, you know, gone out that way. And so all sorts of things he could have asked for, but he just happens to think, well, let's have a book read. Now, of all the books, you know, you could have chosen to read that night, you know, you could have maybe chosen to read a story. I don't know what kinds of things the king liked to read, or if he was much of a reader or not, but of all the books he could have chosen to read, let's read the book of the memorable deeds, the book of the Chronicles. It's kind of interesting that some translations have the book of the memorable deeds of the king. He may be choosing to hear about... Let's hear about the memorable things that I've done, you know, which is kind of interesting. But he hears from the Chronicles. And of all the books of the Chronicles and all the things that could have been read from that night, they happen to open up to the passage about who? About Mordecai and the way that he had saved the king's life. And interestingly enough, the time that initially happened at the end of chapter 2, nothing had been done for Mordecai. If something had already been done for Mordecai, he might have said, "Well, wait a minute. What has been done for Mordecai for this great thing? Oh, it's okay, king. You know, we did him this great honor, gave him some money or whatever. He's given this honor. It's all good. Okay, good. Let's move on." You know, but nothing had been done. And so the king is like, well, let's figure out what to do. And the king, who's always full of good ideas, right, says, "Who's in the court? You know, we can't figure out how to honor this guy, so let's ask whoever happens to be outside." And lo and behold, who happens to be outside in the middle of the night when the king can't sleep? Haman, who can't sleep probably for different reasons. He's up just upset, you know, about Mordecai not bowing down to him. And so here's Haman being called in. And of course, the incredible irony here, of course, the reader knows who the king is planning to honor, but Haman has no idea who the king... Well, Haman thinks he has a pretty good idea. Who would the king want to honor except for me? I mean, just the arrogance is incredible as we go through here. And so all of these coincidences line up, and Haman, I think we just learn a lot about Haman here. When he thinks he's the one about to be honored, what does he ask for? This is just kind of over the top, isn't it? I mean, some clothes that the king has already worn. You know, the horse, not just like a royal horse, but like the king's horse. What does it sound like Haman really wants here? I think Haman wants to be king. I mean, he's not content to have been promoted above all the other officials and all the things the king has already given him. He's never satisfied. And isn't that the way it is with power and with money and with preeminence? You know, it's like, it says in Ecclesiastes, the eye is never satisfied with seeing, nor the ear with hearing. You know, it's vanity of vanities. The more you get, the more you want under the sun. And then Haman just proves that he's got everything he could want, but he wants more. He wants the kingdom. And so Haman's dream, I think, is to be in that position. And so this is what he wants, is to kind of be paraded through the city, kind of pretending to be king for a day. And that's what he really wants. If he could have anything that he wanted, that's kind of what he's asking for by suggesting this to the king for the one that the king wants to honor. And of course, the great moment here, I would just have loved to see the look on Haman's face. Great idea, Haman. Go and do that for Mordecai. And I mean, like, the last name of all the people that Haman would have thought. And just, the disbelief. And then, of course, you've just gone through and you've just made this great idea. And now I love the way the king says at the end there, leave out nothing that you have mentioned. And of course, Haman, why did I have to say all of those things? You know, don't leave anything out. Be true to all the details that you gave. And so can you imagine how it went the day before that second feast? You know, Mordecai has been out all day parading Mordecai through the streets saying, so shall it be done. I can't imagine. I don't know how Mordecai would have done it if he's trying to hide all of his angst and say, like, you know, kind of do it. Oh, shall it be done for the man the king wants to honor? You know, I don't know how this would have gone down. But it's just so ironic that here is Haman honoring the man that he hates most. And just how much this is starting to backfire on him. It is kind of interesting. Haman has to tell everyone to do for Mordecai what Mordecai refused to do for him. Which is just kind of just the way this has been completely reversed. In this context, this is an amazing, amazing story. Okay, so now we're going to see what happens here as Haman leaves this place and goes on. Verses 12 through 14. When Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house mourning and with his head covered. And Haman said to his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. While they were yet talking to him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. So here, Haman had come in the previous time to his family and friends just saying, wow, this is so great, oh, so great, all these great things. The queen has invited me to her feast, except for Mordecai. But now, I mean, he's coming in just utterly defeated. He's just been humiliated in front of the nation, having to parade through the streets the very man that he wants to defeat. And so it's interesting here, the reaction is his wife and his friends seem to realize that things are kind of changing here. And that you're not necessarily going to be able to overcome this one that the king has now chosen to honor. It's interesting that he phrased it, before whom you have begun to fall. And we're going to see the completion of that fall as we get into this next chapter, chapter 7. And again, it's amazing. In one chapter, everything has changed, hasn't it? Like at the beginning of the chapter, the Jews have been mourning, and now it's Haman who's mourning, going back, you know, defeated to his family. And again, Esther and Mordecai, they're not here. God is the one who is working to save his people and to use his servants according to his will. So Esther chapter 7, verses 1 through 6. So the king and Haman went in to feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine, there it is again, after the feast, the king again said to Esther, what is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. Then Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people,
to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Who is he, and where is he, who has dared to do this?" And Esther said, "A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And again, just a dramatic, dramatic moment as Esther reveals these things. And again, Esther does the same thing that has been done already in the story, doesn't she? You remember when Haman was making his request to say, "There's this people, O king, among you who are plotting against you, and they're not worth keeping around," and all these things, but he never says who it is. And of course, here Esther gets the king's anger going. I'm asking you for my own life and the life of my people. Wait, what's going on? You know, that we're going to be annihilated. We're going to be destroyed. Who is it? Who is it that's done this? It's Haman. You know, and so she gets the king's anger riled up and then directs his anger at the object. So she gets it going before she reveals who it is. Just interesting. The saves the name right there until the end. Doesn't this remind you of Nathan? David? How Nathan gets David's anger going. "The man who did this deserves to die. You are the man." And here's the king. "Who has done this? Who would dare do this thing?" Our dinner guest, Haman, is the one who has done this thing. Now think about this for just a minute. You're the king. You have made this edict that all the Jews are to be put to death. And now the guy who's putting you just find out, oh wait, Esther's a Jew? Now remember, Esther's taking a bit of a risk here as she reveals her people, reveals her lineage. She's been in this position for, if we calculate correctly, 4 or 5 years. And the king said, wait a minute, what? You're a Jew? You know, and this could have gone very differently for Esther if things had been different. But here, the king has his anger aroused and it's directed at Haman. But the king is in a tough spot, because the king is the one who gave his signet ring to Haman to say to annihilate the Jews. It's his own edict that's going to annihilate Esther. So what's the king to do? The law of the Medes and the Persians is unchangeable, right? So the king is in a tough spot here, but we're going to see once again something happens to go on that gives the king an opportunity. Verses 7 through 10. It says, "And the king arose in his wrath and from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the palace where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, 'Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house?' As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance to the king, said, 'Moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high.' And the king said, 'Hang him on that.' So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated." It's just incredible how when the Lord works, everything is turned completely on its head, isn't it? That as the Lord has worked in the background through all of this, the king doesn't necessarily know what to do. Of course, the king rarely knows what to do in this book. But now he's like, okay, what am I going to do? But then when he comes back in, what is Haman doing? He is pleading, begging for his life. It's interesting that now Haman has been so, you know, just in a fuss about a Jew not falling down before him. And now what is he doing? Falling down before a Jew. Begging for his life. And the tables have turned completely. And so Haman begs here. And of course he's doing this apparently in some kind of chamber on this couch. And so when the king comes back in from the garden and sees, here's the queen and here's Haman in the presence, I suspect that the king may have known that Haman wasn't trying to assault the queen. But when he comes back in and hears the queen and hears Haman alone together, the king sees his opportunity. Because the king can't necessarily do anything just on the basis of, who made this edict? Oh, wait. Haman did, but I kind of made this edict. He can't react to that. And so Haman has just given the king the perfect opportunity to go ahead and take Haman out of the way while the king's anger is aroused. So it's just amazing that the king has made this the decree, but now Haman provides the excuse to get rid of himself. Again, just the way the situation happens to happen. These coincidences keep adding up. And so Haman is hanged on his own gallows. It's also kind of interesting that once again, the idea doesn't come from one of the guys, or it comes from one of the eunuchs here, but again, it's one of the other guys that gives the idea to the king. One of the eunuchs in attendance said to the king, "Hey, I know of just the thing. Haman has prepared this gallows. Let's hang him on that." And if parading Mordecai through the streets of the city wasn't enough, Haman is hanged on the very gallows that he prepared for Mordecai, and he's the one 75 feet up in the air being hung for everyone to see. Incredible. It's amazing to me, as you think about reading this story for the first time with somebody, I hope you get the opportunity to do that someday. If you're studying with someone who hasn't studied the Bible before, to get to read this, and just to stop at different points and ask them, what do you think is going to happen? Because I just don't think that any of us reading this story for the first time would guess how chapter 6 and 7 go down, and how Haman ends up getting destroyed. It is just incredible. And so as we draw things to a conclusion this evening, just think about all the coincidences that have led up to this point. In chapters 1 through 5, that Vashti refused and left a vacancy as queen. Esther, of all people, was chosen queen. Mordecai just happened to discover that plot against the king. Mordecai happened to not be rewarded at that time for the king. The lot happened to fall on the 12th month, which gave the Jews enough time to be able to deal with this. That's going to become more significant in our next lesson. The king accepts Esther when she comes before him and holds out the golden scepter. That was one of the most amazing things in this whole thing, that he actually did that. And of course, in chapter 6 alone, the king can't sleep on that night. He chooses to hear a book. Specifically, he chooses the Chronicles. Specifically, he chooses the part about Mordecai. He wants to reward Mordecai and doesn't say, oh well. And then Haman happens to be in the courtyard. I mean, you go on and on and on. And this isn't even a complete list. I encourage you sometimes to just go through the book of Esther on your own and count up the coincidences in Esther. It's incredible that as we go through, I believe we see the hand of the Lord in each and every page of this book, even though his name is nowhere to be found. And so as we think about some application, one of the things that should humble us about this is that sin will backfire on you. And if we're acting in a prideful and arrogant and self-centered way, don't be surprised when those things end up flying right back in our face. And haven't we experienced that sometimes? When what seemed like such a good idea at the time, and that path that seemed to promise so much, was really the path that led to our own slavery and our own demise. It's when we die to ourselves and take up our cross and follow Jesus that we really can find the purpose and fulfillment and exaltation. It's he who humbles himself who will be exalted. Numbers 32:23, you remember in the law that it says, be sure your sin will find you out. And Haman, when everything seemed to be going his way, when he pursued the one thing that he thought he could get control of, it all backfired on him. And we just need to remember that when we're being tempted, don't we? Because in that moment, it just seems like everything is going to be fine. It's going to be okay. But man, we need to remember that the Lord sees what's happening in secret. The Lord knows what's all happening. And he can bring disaster right back on our own heads. You look at what happened to David in 2 Samuel, as we've been studying in our adult class on Wednesday night. Just how much sin, as good as enticing it may look in the moment, there are awful, awful consequences if we're willing to stop and think. And of course, just that God is always present and working, even in situations where it seems that he is so far away. These Jews had to feel so far away from God, so far away from the temple. Again, the Jews had already returned, and they're getting news, bits and pieces of what's going on. But it doesn't seem like they're ever going to get back. Is God really still here? You know, does God care about his people? Sometimes we get in a mode where we feel like that. We feel like God's not really working in my life. God's not really here. But I think the book of Esther reminds us that even though his name may not be all over the place, God is here. And God is working.
God is working and answering prayers and opening doors. I'm reminded of Paul's request for prayer at the end of Ephesians 6. You remember where he says, and pray for me also, that I might make known the mystery of God, the gospel, with boldness as I ought to make it known. And God is active in our evangelism. God is active in opening doors, is active in providing opportunities for us. And you never know what's going to happen. We could go and spend the rest of the night telling about stories of God's providence and getting people in contact with other people and answering prayers that may have been prayed years ago. And it's just incredible to think. It's a lot easier to see in retrospect. It's easy to think back and say, yes, God was working. But the challenge is to think now and then remember that God is working, even now. And of course, we're reminded of things like Philemon, where all of these things had happened to where Philemon ended up in the prison with Paul, ended up being converted and was being returned to Onesimus, his master. And Paul says, well, perhaps this is why. That it's important for us to remember that God's active, but not try to read too much into that. But Paul still says, wow. It reminds me of the statement that Mordecai makes to Esther, right? Perhaps this is why that you come to the kingdom for such a time as this. It may well be. And we need to remember when we're in different situations that the Lord is working. And it may well be that he's brought us into some situation for a specific purpose. And while we may not know all the details about that, that doesn't diminish the responsibility and the encouragement that we can take in those situations to do what's right and to serve the Lord. And I just love what Paul says at the end of his life as he's recounting his first defense in 2 Timothy 4, 16 through 18. He says, all deserted me. And that's very much the way that these people may have felt. But Paul remembered, even though all had deserted him, but the Lord stood by me and strengthened me. And it may be that you're in some situation right now where you need to remember that, where it may feel like the Lord is far from you. But if you are with him, if you draw near to God, he will draw near to you as he drew near to Esther and Mordecai and took care of them, even in the midst of some really hopeless situations. Thank you for your kind attention tonight. We're going to extend the invitation. If you're here tonight and you know that you're without the Lord, you know that if you were to die, that the Lord would bring your sin back upon you because you're not forgiven of that sin. If you know that tonight and you know what you need to do to be saved, that you need to repent of that sin and to wash it away in the waters of baptism, you can do that before you leave tonight. And if you're here tonight and you have been far from the Lord or you just need encouragement, if there's any way that we can help you to draw near to God and to trust in him tonight, please come to the front while we stand and while we sing.